listening to The Martial Brain, the podcast that explores the intersection between the martial arts, science, critical thinking, skepticism, and that wacky organ that floats inside our skull in a pool of cerebrospinal fluid, making life unpredictably inspiring, infuriating, and sometimes just batshit crazy. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. The Strange Tale of Howard Bone, Part 1. One day back in the early 1980s, I was finishing up a martial arts demonstration in my beautiful hometown of Evansville, Indiana, when I was approached by an unusual old gentleman. He was of medium height, elderly, mostly bald-headed with buzz-cut gray hair on the rest of his head, and gray whiskers of about the same length on his face. He was missing a few teeth, and what teeth remained were tobacco-stained. As he got closer, he squinted at me through thick glasses. There was the telltale bulge of a dip of tobacco at one corner of his bottom lip. Both of his arms were heavily tattooed, which was far less common in the early 1980s than it is today. He bowed gravely in the Japanese manner before saying in a faint, somewhat squeaky voice, "Allow me to offer my compliments for an excellent demonstration and to introduce myself. My name is Howard Bone, but in my youth, my fighting name was Professor Nelson." Oh no, not another one. If you have listened to the three episodes so far of this podcast entitled Weird Tales of the Rising Phoenix Martial Arts Academy, you know that I presented in them narratives describing some of the truly odd characters I have met as a result of my martial arts career. At first, Mr. Bone seemed to me like yet one more martial arts wannabe oddball. But Howard, while definitely eccentric and quirky, was to prove himself deserving of more respectful treatment. After introducing himself, he pulled me aside to a secluded alcove, looked carefully around as if to assure that no one else would see, and then pulled up his pants leg. His leg was as covered with tattoos as were his arms. "Do you recognize that?" he whispered in a conspiratorial tone. "I'm not sure what you mean," I answered, wondering where this was going. "There," he said, pointing directly at a smaller tattoo that was almost lost among the larger, more elaborate ones adorning his scrawny leg. "Yes," I said, that's a yin-yang symbol." Howard held up a hand to stop me. "Oh, my friend, it's so much more than just that. That is the symbol of the servers." "Okay, I've never heard of the servers." He went on to explain. "The servers were a secret organization of assassins in ancient China." He left that statement hanging, obviously waiting for me to take the bait and ask him more about his association with the servers. I didn't want to feed that particular beast at that particular moment, so I changed the subject. After chatting a while, I decided that Howard, while seemingly eccentric, was probably harmless. And when he asked if he could drop in at my academy for a visit, I told him that he was welcome at any time. Howard showed up the next day, greeting me again with a Japanese bow, which was how he would continue to greet me each time we met in the future. I had been a bit busy when we first met, but on this day I had time to chat, so I asked Howard more about his history. He explained that he had joined a carnival as a young man, and that he had done many jobs and learned many skills there. Among these were serving as the talker or barker. That entailed verbally exhorting the potential customers, or marks as the carnies called them, to come see the attraction at a given stage or within the confines of a given tent. He also performed as a magician, which was his favorite job. His stage name was Cardo, with a K. I still have a business card that he gave me embossed with that name. And finally, another job he filled was fighting in the ring as part of what were called at shows. At being short for athletic. This was essentially an early form of professional wrestling. Howard explained to me that some of the fights were worked in the same way that modern pro wrestling is. That is, the outcome was predetermined, making the event more of a show than a fight. But, he pointed out, a good number of them were not worked, meaning they were real fights. He said, "I didn't win them all, but I won more than I lost, and almost always fought men bigger than me." Howard told me that he had learned to fight from the India Rubber Man in one of the early carnivals he hooked up with. India Rubber Man was a common carnival name for a contortionist. Howard called his style of fighting Ito Ryu Jitsu. I had heard of Ito Ryu Kenjutsu, a highly respected Japanese sword style, but never Ito Ryu Jitsu. Be that as it may, I take no position in this podcast as to the accuracy and or authenticity of Howard's claims. I merely present them as I remember them. He told me that he was the only fighter in the carnival stable that was not a large or very strong man. He also said that he taught a number of techniques to the other wrestlers during their downtime. When the show started, he would stand in line with the other fighters, wearing glasses and a judo gi, presenting quite a contrast to the other hulking wrestlers. He would be introduced as Professor Nelson, or more frequently as Judo Man. Howard Riley was quick to point out that he never studied judo, but that the carnival boss felt it was better to use a term that some people in the crowd understood, judo, rather than Ito Ryu. The barker would explain in dramatic and challenging terms to the crowd that each fighter in this array of athletes was ready to take on any or all comers from the local population. When a local tough guy would step up to take the bait, he was allowed to select his opponent. Since Howard was by far the smallest of the carnival fighters, he was frequently selected early in this process. Ideally, when each of the local fighters had selected an opponent, the card was set and it was almost time for the fights to begin. But before that happened, a carnival official would usually surreptitiously pull aside each of the local challengers and make them an offer. For a nominal fee, the carnival boss would make sure the local boy would win what appeared to be a hard-fought battle. The fix would be in. Sometimes the offer would be accepted, and the performance of the worked fight went forward. Other times, the local man would insist that he needed no help to win the fight. And then a truly and legitimately contested fight would take place, untainted by the theatrics and combative fakery of the worked bouts. Sometimes the local tough guy would accept the offer of a fixed fight, but then get overly abusive of his cooperative carnival adversary once the bout was underway. When that happened, the fight would revert to a real one. None of the carnival fighters would be expected to take unnecessary damage, at least in the more reputable shows. As a matter of fact, when a local fighter violated the agreement like this, the carnival boss, at the end of the round, would often substitute another carnival fighter for the first one to fight in the subsequent rounds, carefully selecting his most competent fighter to go in and teach this local yokel a lesson. The boss frequently chose Howard to fill this role. This kind of substitution might also happen in one of the legitimate unworked fights if the local fighter was breaking the rules, which were essentially the rules of professional wrestling. Again, Howard was often selected to be the one whose job it was to punish the abusive local fighter, and he was encouraged to fight even dirtier than his opponent did, as well. So Howard had to be ready for either the athletic and acting challenge of plausibly losing the worked fight, or the combative challenge of really fighting a man who could be anything from a huge specimen to a trained boxer or a wrestler. He told me that the first time his boss told him in advance that he was to throw the fight, lose it on purpose, he was stunned and angered. He hadn't understood that particular little-discussed aspect of the game when he got into it, and no competent, proud young fighter would be happy with the idea of throwing a fight. His boss told him that if he didn't do as he was told, his pay would be docked by the huge sum of $50. Well, at least huge for those days. We're talking the late 40s. Howard knew which side his bread was buttered on. He said, "Yes, sir," and threw the fight. It was obvious that Howard loved talking about his fighting career, and I kept plying him for more stories. After obliging me for a while, he stopped, got a childlike gleam in his eye, and asked me, "So, young man, would you care to test out your skills on me?" His attitude seemed less like a challenge and more like that of a kid asking a friend if he wants to skip school and play hooky with him. To hear my answer and find out what happens next, listen next time to part two of The Strange Tale of Howard Bone. Anyway, that's what I think, but I could be wrong. Let me know what you think, or check out old episodes of The Martial Brain at my website, rpmartialarts.com. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. The Martial Brain is produced by Raging Squirrel Productions in association with the Rising Phoenix Martial Arts Academy. If you like the podcast and would like to help it grow, go to iTunes or Stitcher and give it an honest rating and review. Contact me with questions about the Martial Brain or the Rising Phoenix Academy at our website, rpmartialarts.com.